AFRS Sports Reel. This is the AFRS Sports Reel, listening time for all you sports fans. Another session of close-ups from the world of sports, with your favorite close-uppers, Bill Brandt, Ed Thorgerson, and Sam Bulk. To start things off, let's listen to a familiar voice with a story fresh from the baseball park. It's Sam Balter spinning another one for the book.
Absenteeism was not invented in an aircraft factory. It has happened on many an occasion in baseball. In August 1934 at Sacramento, California, a Sacramento hurler felt this very strongly. The first Portland man up in the fourth inning hit a fly to right field, whereupon it was discovered, rather belatedly, that absenteeism had reared its ugly head. There was no fielder there. Sacramento's right fielder, Frenchy Bordagaray, had neglected to take his accustomed position at the start of the inning. The ball dropped for a double, and it so unnerved the pitcher that he was batted from the box in that inning. Which brings us to the strange story of the absent batsman, the case of the guy who drew a base on balls while sitting on the bench. Impossible? No, it happened to Joe Donovan, first baseman for Springfield in 1929. Opposing Springfield that afternoon was Clyde Hatter of Dayton. Clyde is the same wild young man whose control has been notoriously like Tojo's scruples, hard to find. You may know him better as the Mad Hatter, one-time Louisville twirler and Detroit Tiger rookie. Hatter's first pitch to Donovan was right by the batter's knuckles. In fact, he said the ball had nicked him. The umpire insisted it had nicked the bat. Joe Dunn, the Springfield manager and one of baseball's best moaners, joined in the argument. Donovan howled and moaned in protest. He offered his hand as proof that he'd been hit. But the umpire was firm. "Play ball," he said. "Play ball." "No," said Donovan, "I'm injured." And he walked to the bench and made a great show of laboriously going about the business of taping his hand. "Play ball," said the umpire again. Donovan continued the taping. Finally, the umpire motioned to Hatter to go ahead and pitch. Hatter was a little uncertain about it all, but the umpire was insistent. Finally, Hatter wound up and threw the ball to the plate. There was nobody up there, but Hatter's pitch was miles too high. "Ball one," said the umpire. Then he looked at Donovan and said, "Get up here." Donovan said no, he was in no condition to bat. He'd been hit. Hatter threw another one, almost into the dirt, ball two. The umpire now looked a little pleadingly at Donovan. Donovan shook his head, nothing doing. The umpire motioned to Hatter. Here came the pitch. Ball three, and then it was ball four. Venom in his eyes, the umpire looked over at Donovan and told him to take his base. He had just been walked. Walked while sitting on the bench. And so Donovan ambled the first from his position in the dugout, the first and only man in the history of baseball ever to draw a base on balls while sitting in the dugout. It's one for the book.
That was fine, Sam Balter. And here's a fellow who must knit in his spare time because he's always got a yarn or two up his sleeve. Ed Thorgerson. Unravel, Ed.
Mr. L.T. Dawson, a listener in Yakima, Washington, asks an interesting question in his letter that arrived the other day. He writes, "Every once in a while I hear you talk about somebody throwing a screwball. Now, you have particularly mentioned Carl Hubble. Well, tell me, is the screwball anything like the fadeaway old Christy Mathewson used to throw?" The answer is yes. Christy Mathewson's fadeaway would be known today as a screwball. In spite of all you may have heard about outshoots and inshoots, outdrops and indrops, most pitchers have only one curve ball. When a right-hander throws it, it breaks away from a right-handed batter and in towards a left-handed batter. When a left-hander throws it, it breaks in toward a right-handed batter and away from a left-handed batter. The screwball is exactly the opposite. It's thrown with a reverse twist of the wrist, which makes it spin in a contrary direction from the orthodox curve. When a right-hander throws a screwball, it breaks in toward a right-handed batter and away from a left-handed batter. And when a left-hander throws it, it breaks away from a right-handed batter and in toward a left-handed batter. You follow me? And in addition, the screwball has a quick dropping action, like a sinker. Speaking of screwballs, when Uncle Frankie Frisch was manager of the St. Louis Cardinal Gas House Gang about 12 years ago, while Bill Hallahan was slowing up, his smoke ball had lost a lot of zip. So one day he said to Frisch, "Frankie, what would you say if I started to work on a screwball?" Well, Frankie threw up his hands. "Don't, Bill. Please don't," he pleaded. "With Pepper Martin and Dizzy Dean on this club, well, I got all the screwballs I can handle now." I doubt that many of you hunters would call a porcupine a dangerous wild animal. We all know his quills can be painful, but we're also sure he doesn't shoot them, as many people still believe. And the only way he can deal out misery is for some city slicker to attempt to grab him. Yet a porcupine came close to causing some very acute discomfort, if not actual danger, to a young couple from Tacoma, Washington. In the late summer of 1940, Mr. and Mrs. Dick Thompson decided to get away from the salt water for a spell and explore one of the rivers in northern Washington. Their choice was the Methow, and their plans were to go by canoe, if possible, all the way to Slate Creek Pass. That's where the river rises in the Cascades. So they drove to Wenatchee on the Columbia River, where they left the car. With their outboard putt-putting merrily, it didn't take long to ascend the Columbia and turn into the Methow. They passed the little settlement of Twisp and made their last gas purchase at Winthrop. From then on, they were in virgin wilderness, a paradise for two such confirmed fishermen. When the river grew too shallow and rocky for the outboard motor, they left it on a sandy beach that had been their camping place for a night and paddled on. Finally, they could go no farther and reluctantly turned back toward civilization. The next day at noon, they were again on the spot where they'd left their motor. Planning to stay there not more than an hour, they neglected to draw up the canoe and merely tied it by its painter to a tree on the bank. They were hungry and wanted a hot lunch, but their stay 3 nights before had used up all the nearby firewood, so back from the river they went, back into the heavy timber. One thing after another distracted them in their wood gathering. There was a doe that refused to be startled even when they approached to within 50 feet. A pair of chattering squirrels, a set of bear tracks in the soft loam that looked like they might have been made recently. Well, it was an hour before they strolled back to the beach, and there, lo and behold, floating away from the shore was their canoe, its painter neatly cut near the tree to which it was tied. Dick knew there was only one thing to do if they were to get back to Winthrop. The weeds along the shore were too thick for fast travel, so into the river he plunged. The current swept him off his feet, and he was forced to swim for it. The bitter cold of the water soon tied his muscles into a clove hitch. And then, almost a mile downstream from their camping spot, the canoe grounded on a sandbar, and Dick was able to catch up with it and hold on. Slowly and painfully, he paddled back, half frozen, and so tired his arms could barely swing the wooden blade. When he reached his wife, she pointed to something on the bank. It was a fat porcupine, and still dangling from its mouth were a few shreds of hemp. Dick had heard that a porcupine will chew up an axe handle or a gun stock for the traces of salt left on them by perspiration. But he overlooked the fact that the painter, after long use on Puget Sound, was impregnated with salt. The little animal's craving had almost set them afoot with no supplies in a trackless wilderness. So Dick hands out this bit of advice. When you're going into porcupine country by water, either drag your boat or canoe onshore or use a chain painter. Dick says the next trip he makes, he's going to use both. On another subject, Fred Corcoran, the Pro Golfers Association tournament manager at Jacksonville, Florida, has some advice for the golfer. Know your sport, says Fred, and how to talk about it. And he reels off this list of golf lingo, which all good golfers should know. A bogey means a score a fair player makes on a given hole, not necessarily one over par. If you're two over par, that's a buzzard. One over par is a bat. That's his new one, a bat. One under par, a birdie. Two under, an eagle. Three under, a double eagle. And, mister, when that dream comes true and your ball sails straight from tee to cup and you've panned that hole in one, that, brother, is a dodo.
Thank you, Ed Thorgerson. We'll be tapping that sleeve another time. But right now we're off to the races with another Bill Brandt special, Once in a Lifetime.
In 1936, the Derby winner came through in Maryland, Assault's Old Man, Bold Venture. In 1938... the winner is the Delaware Maryland horse. The Hope of Maryland lands underneath that blanket of black-eyed Susans, that robe of flowers that means victory in the Preakness. And that's our story now, 1938. The Delaware Maryland horse that comes home from the Derby a loser, and here he is at the Preakness, the hope of the home crowd. In 1938, Foxcatcher sent Dauber to the Derby, the son of Pennant and Ship of War. The boys didn't give Dauber much chance in the Derby. The Derby favorite is Fighting Fox. And Lauren is there, too. Herb Wolf's Lauren with Eddie R. Carroll up. But when the Derby field comes under that wire, Dauber from Foxcatcher is crowding right up close. The winner is Lauren. This is number one for Eddie R. Carroll. R. Carroll's first win at Churchill Downs. Second by a length, Dauber. So now we move from Kentucky to Maryland. Here at the Preakness, they're going to the post. No Lauren. Lauren's not running today. But here's the Derby favorite, Fighting Fox, and most of the Derby field. Me Now, Son Egret, Cravat, Can't Wait, Bull Lee, Bull Whip, Hypocrite, a great field. The 14th of May, the merry month of May, springtime and roses. But look, right here now today in Baltimore, it's raining cats and dogs and little red wagons, raining all over Maryland, but especially at Pimlico. That post parade looks like a march of the wooden soldiers. Every step the horses take, they're up to their fetlocks in slimy mire. The boys in the press box snarl and make faces. They pound their typewriters. It's the worst weather in Preakness history. Some say the worst mud ever seen anywhere. But the Maryland home rooters laugh out loud because it's a Maryland tradition, that mud. Maryland horses love it. They laugh at it. They eat it a while. Then they get tired eating and they go out in front and kick it in other horses' faces. Now they're lined up. The rainstorm hits a new high. You can hardly see the horses through that solid curtain of water. They're off. And here they come. Nine horses, all the same color, mud brown. Nine sets of racing silks, all merging into dead gray almost before they get to the grandstand. Here they go, past the stand. Fighting Fox on top. Me now, right with him. I'll take the Fox. Fighting Fox got a bad break in the Derby, but he's the solid horse here today, and they'll never catch him now. He's out in front. Where's Dauber, the hope of Maryland? Oh, golly, look at him. Yes, going around the first turn, there's two horses way back, chasing all the rest of them. Dauber and Cravat. Dauber is two steps ahead of Cravat. There's nothing in back of Cravat but hoof prints. Licked, says the guy in back of us. Maryland, my eye. There's mud in his mouth and he'll be full of it all the way around. A full meal of Maryland mud and that's all he'll get today. And the guy in front of us turns around and yells, hey, I'll bet you right now. How about it? You want to eat some yourself? Listen, brother, I was down to the barn this morning. Rain slamming down on the roof. And Dauber inside there laughing fit to bust. Just keep your eye on Dauber, brother. Out along the back stretch, all you can see is a solid clump of horses moving along all together. Well, Dauber closed the gap anywhere. He's somewhere in that pack, and that's all you can see in the rain until they hit the top of the stretch. Now it's me now by a length, Fighting Fox, Sun Egret. Look, there's two horses moving up. Dauber? Yep, Dauber. And who's tagging along with him stride by stride? Why, it's Cravat, Johnny Westrope up. Say, Johnny must have picked Dauber as a good pacer. And now Maurice Peters, riding Dauber, begins to ride in earnest. Fighting Fox and Sun Egret look like a couple of weary travelers, practically standing still. Dauber and Cravat breeze right past. Now they go past me now. Why, this is a two-horse race, the two that were last the first time around. Come on, Westrope. And Westrope piles it on. Everything he's got, but that stretch drive is too much. Dauber's running as if it's dry land. The crowd is screaming, Dauber! The winner, Dauber. How far? Wait till Cravat gets here. Oh, it's about 7 lengths. Yes, the Delaware Maryland mutter is in by 7 lengths, and the rain pours harder and harder, and the black-eyed Susans are weeping with joy. May 14th, 1938, the Preakness, when it's mud at Pimlico and the local hope moves from last to first in a roaring rush, first by 7 lengths. That's all it takes to make a Maryland once in a lifetime.
Well, that horse ER just about does it for today. But if you want more of same by America's ace sports commentators, watch for the AFRS Sports Reel. We'll return soon. The Armed Forces Radio Service.